You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
We've been trying to get Ajoa to Greenbelt for 3 years, and unsurprisingly, she's a very busy lady. Now, many of us might know her best as Lady Danbury in Bridgerton, which is why I've got my frock on today. But she has a long and distinguished career in stage, in film, television, acting. And Ajoa is also a person of Christian faith and a reader in the Church of England. But that is... big whoops. That's quite enough from me. I'm going to hand over to Chinny McDonald to be in conversation with our very special Greenbelt guest, Ajoa Addo. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. It's really lovely to see you all. We'll probably be competing with Beer and Hymns at some point, but hopefully you will be able to hear because the sound is so great.
Or we'll join in.
I'm really excited about this conversation. We are just going to have a chat and to find out a bit more about Ajoa, discuss a few things, but we'll also have some time later on for you to ask her some questions. And as Katie just said, you are currently best known for being Lady Danbury in Bridgerton. But you've had a long and varied career.
I'm old.
You started very young. On screen. How do you introduce yourself now beyond that role?
I don't know that I introduce myself. Do you know what's great about things like this, times when people come together like this, is everybody is equally interesting. Everybody has an equally interesting life story to tell, opinions about things, perspectives on the world. So I quite like just chilling and listening to what other people have got to say these days.
But that's not the gig today. We're talking about you. we've all come to hear about you. But okay, well, let's start with the beginnings of what drew you into this space. Theatre, the arts, film, drama. What first drew you into acting? How did you start?
I don't know that... I was one of those kids who... I directed Blythe Spirit when I was 8. I didn't really know the story of Blythe Spirit, but I know there was a ghost. So... I was just one of those kids, you know. I used to read the famous 5 books, and then we had our own little club, the famous 4. I made us little books with pink card, and I stitched the middle with paper, and we had pens, and we'd go and sit in the bus shelter and note down the number of car number plates. It was the 60s. It was the Cotswolds. Cars were quite exciting. So I was just one of those kids. I was always dressing up. I loved it. I love stories. But where I grew up, it was cows and sheep. I could milk a cow if we were desperate. I can still remember. It wasn't a world where you did school plays. There was the panto, which is the highest form of art. Oh yes, it is. Hey. Everybody's had their coffee. But I didn't know that it was something you could do for a job. Where I grew up, clever girls, I was a clever girl, maybe they worked for a bank or a building society, or maybe they did the civil service exams. That was what clever girls did. Or they got married. Those were the choices. So acting was on nobody's radar. Or if you were a good African daughter, which I clearly wasn't, you would be a lawyer or a doctor or an accountant. That was kind of it. I did modern languages. We weren't allowed to do drama in my school because it wasn't considered a proper subject until you were in the sixth form. If you were doing A-levels, you were allowed to do O-level drama. Yes, A-levels and O-levels. So I did O-level drama, and that's sort of... I went to the theatre to see a play in 1979 in Bristol. That was our nearest town. And there was a play called Plenty by David Hare. Plenty is about a young woman, set during the Second World War, young woman in London. She's a secretary. She also speaks French. She gets scooped up and sent to do special ops in France, where, of course, she's fabulous. She can run special ops. Of course, she falls in love with a Frenchman. Of course she does. A resistance fighter. Why would you not? And then after the war, she comes back to London and she has to go back into her box and be a secretary again. And she feels like her life is over because she's found the thing that she's brilliant at. And I went to see this play when I was in the upper six. I was anorexic. My parents were getting divorced. I was really depressed. I was sitting the Oxbridge entrance exams. I had a super high chance of going to Cambridge to read law, blah, blah, blah. Had a nervous breakdown, didn't do any of that. But I remember going to see this play sort of just slightly prior to the nervous breakdown and sitting in the cheap seats in Bristol Old Vic, Kate Nelligan is playing the lead. Yes, thank you, Kate Nelligan, marvellous. And I just remember sitting in the dark, weeping by the end of this play and thinking two things. One, this character has nothing to do with my life. Why is it making me cry so hard? And two, there is something magical that's happening between me in the audience and what's happening on stage. And there's something transformative. I got that even at 16. There's something transformative about this and I want to have a part of it. And also that sense of, so there is something that I am built for that I could be doing. And if I were doing it, I would be being my best self. I got that all from that thing. And so I think that was the first time I had a sniff that there was something magical about this relationship between the story, the teller, and the audience. And that, you know, three is a magic number, as we all know. For me, that triune conversation has been what's always been the thing that I've been fascinated by. And I had a sense that it was what I wanted to do. I still didn't do it because I didn't know how you did it, because who does acting for a job? Nobody. So I didn't. I worked in a bank. I worked for Lloyds Bank in 1981 to 82 during the Falklands. All the girls were wearing Lady Di blouses, which you can see I'm built for. And and all the boys were in the TA wanting to go and give the Argies some. It was not my world. And I was very bad at numbers. So I lasted a year and a day. And then I went to... I was so sick of it that I actually agreed to go and study law as an escape. So that's what I did.
So you then went to study law?
I went to study... Sorry, just getting the whole life story.
Sorry.
So then I went to study law at Bristol Polytechnic, not the University of the West of England. It's a polytechnic. Polytechnics were great. And my big blessing doing the law degree was not the law degree. It was being scooped up by a woman in the second year of Turkish heritage, said to a woman in the third year of Indian, Guyanese, Irish heritage, there's one in the first year, get her. Because they were Bristol Black Women's Group. Because in those days, black was a political term that meant what we would say off colour today. So I joined Bristol Black Women's Group. We went to Greenham, we encircled the base, we did all of that. Yeah. My world was opened to literature that I had never come across in the middle of the Cotswolds. Why would I have? You know, the Alice Walkers and the Tony Cade Bambaras and the Toni Morrisons and the Paulie Marshalls and the Audre Lordes. And this whole new world opened to me. And I met a woman in Bristol Black Women's Group who was an American actress, Deborah John Wilson. And she... when I packed in, inevitably, when I packed in my law degree, year two, land law, done. My father on the phone, just finish it. Just finish it. Which is exactly what I'd say to any of my kids if they bailed today. But when I packed in the law degree, Deborah said, come and take my class. And I was like, okay. She was running a drama class out of St. Werburgh's Community Centre. So I went, oh, St. Werburgh's in the house? So got married in St. Congrats. So anyway, so I took her acting class and then she got funded by dear old Ken Livingstone to do a show at the Drill Hall in London. And she said, come up and audition for my show. I was like, okay. I didn't know what you were supposed to do. I took a passage from E.P. Thompson's The Making of the English Working Class. That was my audition speech. E.P. Thompson, for our younger listeners, was a magisterial history academic. And it's a good read. The Making of the English Working Class. Very good read. Anyway, I got the job. I left my bedsit in Bristol. I went to live with my girlfriend in Tooting Broadway. And Tooting Broadway, oh my gosh. Anyway, I did the job. It was fantastic. It was a play written by a black woman. The cast was five black women. It was 1984. We did it at the Drill Hall, the Oval House, Acton Community Centre. And then I thought I was going to go back to Bristol and continue with my funny little life. And then I thought, oh, no, I'm not. And I stayed in London. I moved into a squat in Brixton. I learned how to lay concrete floors, hang ceilings, build, you know, do you want glass in that window tonight in the coldest winter for many a year? You better glaze it then. So I learned how to do all those fabulous things and how to live cooperatively and do all of that. And then I thought, I'm going to stay in London and be an actor. And then didn't work for a year, cleaned a lot of toilets, modelled for life drawing classes. But the wonderful thing was the remarkable generosity of other black actresses who started to tell me about auditions. So this is 1984. Auditions that would put me in competition with them for the gobsmackingly small number of jobs that were available. So, that generosity has always stayed with me, that if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't have a career. And the mantra has to be, when you get in the door, open the door wider. It's got to be. So, So eventually, I got a job with a theatre company, small-scale socialist feminist touring theatre company. And I found out I was pregnant and was offered the job in the same week. So I had to say, yes, I'd like the job, but I'm pregnant. And there was a slight pause. And then they went, well, we'll have to institute a maternity policy then, won't we? And I toured until I was 8.5 months pregnant, my 11-year-old boy just getting more and more slumped over. Had the baby and was back at work within a week with baby Jessie, and she came on tour with us. And that was I feel so grateful that I entered the profession during the last knockings of truly radical, open ways of working.
Wow. So I'm fascinated by this because even in that kind of short potted history up to a certain point, I've read lots about you, I've seen you on screen for most of my life, but you've completely shattered my preconceptions of who you are.
Good.
Yeah, and I thought you might like that, because I was going to ask you about, is there something in you that wants to do that, that wants to break out of moulds? Has that always been the case? And I'm thinking particularly of you when you talked about being a person of colour in the 60s in the Cotswolds. Yeah. What was that like? Is there part of you that doesn't like conforming rather than wanting to conform to people's perceptions of who you should be?
I think my whole life, my career, my politics, the way I want to live, who I want to spend time with, is all about saying every human being is a unique soul, and every unique soul has their own desires, tastes, gifts, blessings, fears, hopes, and dreams. And none of those unique souls, desires, hopes, dreams, fears, and all the rest of it, has anything to do with their fleshy overcoat. So for me, that or the accident of their birth. So that fleshy overcoat may be their gender, their race, their accident of their birth, may be their economic bracket, the religion they're born into, the country they're born into, who they love, how they love, all of that has nothing to do with anybody but that unique soul. That's what I truly believe, that God created unique soul. You know that thing where, I don't know if, it's just like, I was thinking about this morning, because I thought this might be a bit of our conversation. I was thinking about my grandson, who arrives back in the UK tomorrow. My daughter and her husband have lived in Cambodia for the last 5 years, and Luca was born there, and he's only ever gone to preschool and nursery with Cambodian children. He is the sweetest natured little soul you could ever meet. He's very thoughtful. He doesn't understand aggression. He's just a nice kid. And already I'm waiting for him to start school in West London and gulping. And part of that is about, I know that he's been raised and sort of ring-fenced into being given permission to be however he is, however he wants to be, whatever he wants to play with, however he wants to dress, whoever he wants to sit and talk to, whatever fascinates him. His parents have been led by his soul's calling in that small body. And he's going to come into a world that will say, you are this, you do this, this is how you should be, this is how you shouldn't be. They should be your people, they shouldn't be your people. And I think that is a tremendous loss. And I grieve the loss of that, as I grieve it for myself and as I grieve it for all of us. Because I think we've been gifted this terrific light that we all have. And to shine that light fully, you need to feel free and safe to shine. And I believe that we... You know, why would we be blessed with this light if we weren't supposed to exercise it? So everything that I'm interested in doing is about making space for light. So the work I do that, you know, we'll talk about, or how I interact with people, or the causes that I advocate for, or social justice, all of that stuff. To me, it's a no-brainer. It's like, why would we want to box ourselves in? Why would we not want to live in the fullness of the blessing that we've been given? Because when we're living in the fullness of our blessing, we can be a blessing for other people, and we can receive their blessing, and the world can feel more like the kingdom come. And that's where I feel like it's a miracle. Every day is a miracle. You know, we're on a burning ball of gas in the middle of the solar system, and we're sitting in the pagoda on a Saturday morning. It's a miracle. And we get trammelled into lives that blinker us, and we forget the miracle. And the miracle is not just the environment around us. The miracle is us. We are walking miracles. And, you know, we exist with God's breath. We exist with God's breath. No breath, no life. So, yeah. What was the question?
Well, it was about breaking out of preconceptions, people, and I wonder whether this is potentially why Bridgerton feels like such a powerful project and such a great fit for you and your kind of history and what you try to do. So, people who aren't familiar with Bridgerton, it's a period drama. Period dramas have long been kind of described or seen as kind of white-only spaces, but there's quite a lot of ethnic diversity within Bridgerton, and some people aren't happy with that. So, I was thinking, Greenbelt has been described as utter woke nonsense. And I think Bridgerton has also been described as utter woke nonsense, this kind of woke agenda of kind of diversity within these kind of period dramas. What does Bridgerton and its project in that respect mean to you? What do you see in that?
Well, let's just go back to the word woke. The word woke is an African-American, that's his genesis. It's an African-American way of thinking, which is about stay alert, stay awake. It's about, you know, stay safe. Be alert to what's around you when you're in an environment that was not made for you or doesn't want to accept you or welcome you in. You have to be woke. Stay woke for your safety. It also means be alert to people, but it can be alert to danger and it can be alert to blessing as well. So for me, it's a wonderful. It's got sadness in it, but it also can be a wonderful thing. And it's a measure of the way our world works that it's been turned into a term of abuse, and it's not a term of abuse. It's a glorious term. So somebody said to Shonda Rhimes has just been up at the Edinburgh Festival, and I was with her a couple of days ago, and she was being interviewed, and somebody said to her, "You know, Bridgerton's been called woke," and she went, "Huh, cute." So, hooray! So for me, that you know, being in Bridgerton is of a piece with everything I was just saying about. Well, my mother was a history teacher. I love history. I can be quite tedious about history. Don't sit with me for too long. You'll be like, yeah, okay, thanks. You know, there is a lot of historical record that says that Queen Charlotte was a woman of African heritage when she first came to this country from Mecklen-Strelitzburg, which was the little German royal family that she was from. She brought the Christmas tree, by the way. It wasn't Prince Albert. Charlotte's tree. When she came, there were complaints in the press about her ugly, thick lips and her ugly, wide nose and her mulatto skin. She was told to powder down for portraits. You know, that's in the press. Why would you say that about somebody that doesn't have some of that heritage in there? And, you know, there was a notion that she was paired with the king that was going to be tricky to marry off because he had mental health challenges. So, you know, put the brown girl and the boy with the mental health challenges together and have an incredibly successful marriage, because why not? For me, you know, Bridgerton's not a documentary. It's an entertainment. That's its primary function. But within the entertainment, why not have some nuggets that make people go, oh? And for me, you know, we don't deal with it in the show, but it's the height of the British Empire. So Britain went unto other countries and other countries came unto Britain. It's nothing particularly radical or earth-shattering. It just becomes it when you haven't seen it, or when you don't know your history, or when you don't know any of that stuff. And then people are surprised and shocked because Queen Charlotte is Golda Rochevelle and not Helen Mirren, and people get confused. But, you know, if you're not taught history, if you're not taught all the history all the time, all the contributions that women have made, all the contributions that the LGBTQIA plus community have made, all the contributions that people of colour have made, you know, it wasn't all white men, all the history. It couldn't be. They'd be exhausted. So you know, to do a... what I love about Bridgerton is it just goes, hello, everybody. Everybody's welcome, if it's your bag. My husband has seen not 1 second of the show. Oh. He's like, I love you. Don't make me sit through it. Fair enough. But you know, it's the welcome is broad. You might just, you know, you might like a bit of will they, won't they. You might like a bit of stately home. There's a nice frock. Oh, look, there's people that look like me in it. Maybe I can watch it a bit more. Oh, look, there's people who might be the same gender who might love each other. You know, it's whatever you want it to be. It's there and it's available and it says welcome. And I can tell you when we've launched the show overseas, South Africa, Poland, New York, London, wherever we've launched the show becomes a safe space for all people to come and be who they be and just like the show. And actually, when I was in Doctor Who, it was the same thing. Whenever there was a Doctor Who thing, it became a safe space for people to just come and be who they be. How lovely. Why not? The world is hard. There should be places where people can just come and be who they be.
Someone asked a two-part question then. Is there something for you about the power of theatre, drama, the arts, to tell stories and create these spaces? But also, in your career, what's your analysis of where the arts are now in terms of representation, creativity, politics? What are you seeing? So, those two parts.
When I go to drama schools, I didn't train. It's the biggest joke. When I go and teach in drama schools where I didn't train, something I will always say to the kids is, yeah, you can come to drama school and you must have felt it as a calling for you, because it's quite hard to get into drama school. I work at RADA and I've been on the audition panel there, and 5,000 people will be applying for 28 places. So it's you have to work hard to get in there. And you must feel it quite profoundly to do it. Slightly off-piste. But one thing I have noticed in the last... No, it's not. It's on-piste. One thing I have noticed in the last couple of decades is the cohort applying for drama schools is reverting back. It used to be fairly middle class, fairly white, fairly comfortably off. And then there was a period where it got more working class and browner. And now it's going back to how it was, because people cannot envisage, if they're on limited incomes, why they should have their children pay over $9,000 a year. That isn't even eating a morsel or finding anywhere to live for several years, and to come out into a profession where, likely or not, you're going to spend your first couple of years waiting tables. I think that's a real shame, because we need more stories. We need audiences to watch shows that look like them, to hear stories that come from them and are rooted in stuff that feels familiar or possible. And, you know, the way that rooting may happen, it might be science fiction, but you know it, you're talking about the loss of a mining community. Do you know what I mean? So there's many ways to do it, but... if we're not getting a cohort coming in as actors, then who are going to play those parts? And that goes through for everything. That goes through into who gets into the world to become producers, commissioning editors, who is behind the camera. So it's all very well having a variety of people in front of the camera, but who's the focus puller? Who's the electrician? Who's building the sets? You know, there's a whole ecosystem that needs also to broaden. And then you get to the stories that are being told. And I still think there's work to do. I'm still waiting to see more stories for women, about women in their 50s and 60s and older. Who buy the most theatre tickets. Who buy the most cinema tickets. Who buy the most books. And then who find themselves being reflected in story the least. So there's work to do in the whole area. I think it's very interesting. We've had the paroxysm of watching George Floyd be murdered live, and then lots of companies in all areas, not just in our industry, but across the board, all leaning in and having diversity and all of that sort of work. And then now we have with Donald Trump and co, we suddenly have a moment where that's all in reverse, and lots of companies have gone, oh, thank God, right, can we stop? Good, right, let's revert to type. That's what's happening now. So I think there is work to do to be vigilant, constantly vigilant, but also talking about this inclusivity as a good thing, not something to bash people's heads, oh, you've got to be inclusive. It's like, why would you not want the richness of the world and the talent pool of the world to enrich your particular endeavour? I think we have to find ways of encouraging people and welcoming people in rather than bashing them, because I think a lot of people post-pandemic especially are pretty scared. I think we all understood what is facts on the ground anyway, which is we're not in control. And I think it scared a lot of people. And I think change scares people. And I think though some of us may want change to come faster, we want people to come along. So I think we have to be patient, and I think we have to be gentle and kind and empathetic and understand that there isn't an us and them. There's only us at different stages. And sometimes that's frustrating. But that's the way it's got to be, because we're all God's children.
So I want to ask how you are, because you're involved in so many different things. You are a very public person with public roles. You've also got family. You've got a lot of things that you're juggling. I want to ask how you are and what difference your faith makes to those times when you might face challenge or people saying stuff on social media. I love this quote from you where you once said in an interview, "For me, church is the place where you can be a hot mess. You don't have to be fine." So how are you?
Generally a hot mess.
Does church help that?
Our old vicar's wife, Jocelyn. Hi, Rach. Our old vicar's wife used to say, "I don't know how people do their life without God. It's like, my life's going to be just as hard as somebody else's, but I've got God in my corner." And I think that's what I feel like. Our faith doesn't mean we swerve anything. Doesn't. It just means that we have someone alongside us while we're doing the not swerving and having to go through the things. Faith is a place of first principles that you can always go back to. My favourite thing to do is lie in the sea face down in the water like that. Okay, you take the load for a minute. God is my inspiration for all things. And I epically fail most of the time. But you come back and have another go. God is the place where I sit and cry and think I've had enough of all of this. And God is the place where I go, "Look at that sunset. That's amazing. You did that. That's brilliant." God is the place where I go when I sit round a table with my kids and my family and just go, "Thanks. This is amazing." Or, I'm with a bunch of friends and we just laugh till we've cried about something, or we've cried till we've laughed about something. And you just go, "Thanks." It's like a friend of mine, when she was giving up smoking, would say, "There's a cigarette for every occasion." "I'm stressed. I need a fag." "I'm thrilled. I need a fag." "I've got to concentrate. I need a fag." "I just want to relax. I need a fag." And there's God for every occasion. A bit better than a fag.
God is better than a fag.
God is better than a fag.
So I'll ask one more question before we open it up to others. But you are very outspoken in things that it feels like you feel like you can't help but say, that these are issues of justice and fairness and equality. Are there times when you have regretted being a prophetic voice, I would say, we would say in describing the church, where you've regretted it or it has come at a cost to you?
I think when you talk about things, I mean, I'm basically a four-year-old going, it's not fair. I mean, it, literally, that's what I feel like. You know, that's the motivation. There's no higher, you know, more esoteric thought than that generally. So why was I involved with fair trade for 20 years? Because there's got to be a way of producing food that doesn't produce misery. You know, I grew up in the countryside. I know that cows in a field are happier than cows on concrete indoors for the whole of their lives. Children should be in school. They shouldn't be sewing sequins on frocks or picking cotton or picking cocoa or enslaved. We have so much child slavery still in the world. I mean, I have kids. Why would I want anyone else's kids to be living miserable? Do you know, to me, it's not anything difficult or complicated.
It's not deep, as the kids would say.
It's not deep, as the kids would say. It seems blindingly obvious to me, but sometimes things that are blindingly obvious are really hard work. You know, because people will say, all right, yes, you're fair trade, that's all very well, but my income is really tiny. You're telling me, Mrs. Actress off of the telly with your big wages, that I should be buying those biscuits as opposed to those biscuits? Those biscuits are what I can afford. And the answer for me would be, you must buy what you can afford. But if you ever get into a position where you could perhaps buy those biscuits, knowing that those biscuits will help somebody down the line who may be in a similarly income-strapped position as you, then just maybe have a think about it. That's what I mean about you don't bong people over the head. You have to meet people. What do we say? God meets us where we are. We have to meet other people where we are. What right do we have to do anything other than that? You know, the judgment is not for us. The judgment is God's. I'm so annoyed I'm going to miss Marilyn Robinson, the great Marilyn Robinson, mm-hmm. Who's going to be, I think she's speaking here tomorrow.
Yeah, No Fly Zone, I think, which is the digital.
No Fly Zone. Yeah. Yes. Anyway, Marilyn Robinson wrote this book called Gilead. She's written many books. They're all marvellous. I would highly recommend. And when I was doing my reader training at Southwark Cathedral, when we got onto the preaching module, and we were recommended Gilead as a book to read, and I hadn't read any of her work before. There's a preacher in the book, in the story of Gilead. There are these two preachers. It's the 1950s. It's a Midwest Kansas town, small dusty town, and they're two old preachers. One's in one church in one end of the town. One's at the other end, and one of the preachers every Sunday morning, his prayer is, "God, get me out of the way this morning." And for me, the Hebrews quote that I can't remember the chapter or the verse that basically says, nothing is to get in the way of a person's relationship with God. That's the gig for me. My job is to be the drain pipe and let the conversation do what the conversation does. And so I think with all the work that I do, I want it to be about getting out of the way. So if my strong opinions about something gets in the way of somebody coming to an understanding of something from themselves, then my strong opinions are not helpful. It's about what's the aim? The aim is to put people into a space where they can live a more fruitful, more abundant, more connected life. So do that. So and that means that, you know, things like just basic little things like in our church, if I'm leading, big strong voice, please. Not everybody has got good hearing. What's the point if people can't hear you? You know, when you've got the service sheet, some churches have, you know, there's the pew sheet and there's the BCP and there's the the hymn book and the... And if you've never... I just think about that person that has spent years walking past that church door thinking, I'm not good enough, I can't go in there, I'm a terrible person. You know, it's not for me. And this is the morning that they've taken their courage in their hands and they've stepped through the door. What will greet them? What's the welcome? How will you make them feel, come in with your hot mess? This is the hot mess town. You're welcome. How, you know, so even if you're doing things like, and now we're going to, you know, now we'll join in with the words of the welcome. It's in bold, the top of page one. just give people the thing so that they can feel like they're part of the gang as well. You know, it's that sort of... It's like Bridgerton Church, it's all the same thing. The welcome is everything.
Utter woke nonsense.
Yes.
Okay, I'm a badge. Right. Thank you so much. Well, over to you. If you would like to ask a question, I see a hand straight up there.
Hello, thank you so much. That was so inspiring. I'm an actor. I've done a lot of small-scale touring theatre, and I just had my daughter about a year ago. And I feel like in an industry which is already so competitive and you feel replaceable all the time, I've just made myself completely unemployable by becoming a mum. I just want to know how you did it, how you made it work.
I just think, you know, the old clichés are clichés because they're true, but it takes a child to raise a village. So I had a child to raise a village. Maybe that's true, actually. Maybe it does take a child to raise a village.
That's a good one.
Yeah. So that isn't an old true cliche because nobody's ever said it before. Basically what I'm saying is I didn't do it on my own. I had amazing friendship groups. I could be a CEO of a captain of industry because the amount of planning it takes is, you know, it's planning is everything. So you have to plan, but the main thing you have to do is say, I'm an actor, this is my blessing, my child's my blessing, I'm having it all, thank you very much.
Slight two-part question. The first bit, when you and, I'm sorry, I can't remember the other actress, had to do the scene about the garden, how did you do it without cracking up? And secondly, do you find that some of the young actors on Bridgerton, do they come to you for advice or do you sort of try and encourage them with all, you know, all that you've gone through, or do you find they're in a completely different space and your what you've been through, which is amazing, is so different from them that they kind of are a bit like, they love you, but they're like, it's so different.
But shut up. When I started out, you would have a bag with 2p's and 10p's and you would all queue for the phone box in the rain so that you could phone home. So I'm from a different planet from them. They're like, what? I don't need to tell them anything because most of them are far more industry literate. You know, they've got managers and stylists and publicists and blah, 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 you know. They've never been in a transit van going up the A1. It's not their world. Whereas I'm glad I have done that, you know, and I do also have all those other things, but to me, they're all hilarious because I have put the set up. I have carried on doing the show while a small child vomits at the front and a nun cleans up the vomit while the show's still going. So I've lived a life. They don't want to hear about that. What was the other bit of your question? Oh, the garden. Yes, Ruth Gemmell. Her name's Ruth Gemmell. Ruth Gemmell and I spend most of our time on set swearing and laughing. I think we appall some of the younger people. And so too with the garden. Yeah, oh my God, older women having sex? Are you kidding? Talking about... I think that's partly why my husband doesn't watch the show. He's like... No. I love Ruth. Ruth did a radio series where she plays a character called Lady Shonagan. I can't remember what it's called now. Anyway, it's marvellous. It's on Radio 4. So I fell in love with Ruth Gemmell's voice before I ever met her. And then my husband, who is a gooner... We're playing them this afternoon. It's going to be very stressful. He and I went to see a film called Fever Pitch with Colin Firth and Ruth Gemmell played the love interest. So he was watching it and you know, he would lean over and go, "That's my life," back Colin Firth's character. And Ruth Gemmell was in that, and she was fantastic in that. So I was super excited to get to work with her in the first place, and that we get to do so much lovely stuff together is, you know, one of my favourite things about doing the show. She's a very funny, very brilliant, very smart and thoughtful actress. So what's great is we can laugh a lot. We are very sweary. Sorry, you can take the girl out the Cotswolds. But she's a super skilled actor, so it's just a pleasure to do scenes with her, because you're acting with somebody who's great, so you can both do showing off. Yeah.
Should we take?
Please, can we take that man?
Okay. Well, we'll take this person. Can you see this person with their hand up?
He's got his hand up. He's over there.
But we'll come back to that, because there might be someone here who's closer to the mic, and we can just take two questions. So one here, and then one over here. Yep, go ahead.
Yeah. So you've done a lot of things, from Casualty, Doctor Who, Bridgerton, which I absolutely love your character. You're my favourite, so thanks. But Christmas adverts, you did Boots. It was such a joyful advert.
It was, wasn't it? It was
what,
fun.
Yeah. What made you want to do that? Because it's so different to everything you've done.
They asked me. They paid me. And I love Christmas. I love Christmas. I'm, you know, I still do the paper chains. My kids are like, "Please, Mum, I beg you, not the paper chains." I'm 39. Why are you making me do paper chains?
You've got to.
It's the law. So I was, anything to do with Christmas, pantos, I love being in panto, I love all of it. So to do that, I was delighted to do it. I was delighted to do it again. It's about saying everybody is entitled to be part of Christmas. So we'll have everybody in. We'll have a variety of elves along with my good self, which I know annoyed people, but hey, ah well, never mind. Change the channel, it's all right. There's other things you can watch. So for all those reasons, I wanted to do it. The director, Dave. What's Dave's surname? What's Dave's surname? Do you remember? Anyway, Dave. Dave works with Janet Jackson, Dr. Dre. I mean, he works with the most fantastic. So working with Dave was a dream, because I was a punk rocker. That's my growing up. I saw The Clash in 1977. I'm a punk rocker till I die. So to work with a guy who makes pop videos doing this as well, that was an added thing. But I think mainly I just wanted to do the thing of going, everybody walks through the doors of Boots at Christmas. I used to get the little talcum powder and perfume spray for my mum every year, box set, from Boots. I mean, everybody goes to Boots. That was my pocket money then. So I wanted to do an advert that said, and everybody still does, and everybody's welcome. And it's Christmas. How fabulous. Christmas is Christmas. What is Christmas? It's Christmas. Christmas. Everybody's welcome. So it was great.
Thank you.
Leeds United fan. I'm longing to know.
Oh, I knew I liked you.
I'm longing to know how a girl from the Cotswolds ends up as a Leeds fan.
Okay, just very briefly. We moved to Leeds when I was 6 months old. We lived there till I was four. And I came back to the Cotswolds with a very strong Yorkshire accent, looking like this. It was a tricky thing for people to cope with. And Leeds United Football Club had the first black player to play at a Wembley Cup final, Albert Johansson. And when we lived in Leeds, my dad, because all the black people knew each other, because there was about seven, my dad knew Albert Johansson. He used to go drinking with Jackie. So I've been Leeds since I could say Leeds.
Hi, I'm kind of interested in your take on this Church of England. As a young person in the C of E, I often get very angry and frustrated with the lack of change. Especially as a young person, it doesn't feel very accessible to me. And obviously, the theme of Greenbelt is Seeds of Hope. So I was just wondering how you find and where you find hope in the Church of England when it feels hopeless sometimes?
Well, I'm a great believer in you have to stay inside the tent and fight. So I'm still in the Labour Party. You have to stay inside the tent and fight, because we want the Church of England to flourish and open and grow and do all the great things that it can do in relationship with other Christian churches, with Jews and Sikhs and Muslims and all faith people. So if your particular church is making you weary, find another church, but stay within the church body. That's the great thing about the Church of England. It's a broad church. It's hard. I've remembered Christmases past where, I might be on the cup and there's a woman priest on the bread, and we've had to consciously go, we might have to have two blokes on that side because not everybody's up for this. And part of you goes, no, everybody just says, come up the front and just get on with it and just take the thing. The love of Jesus, take it. But I don't know that would be God's favourite approach. So sometimes it's hard. I would say make sure you have a sustaining group of people around you who you can go and have a moan at, have a pray with, and hold your nerve, trust God, mustard seeds, all of that, and keep keep your eye on the prize. We want the kingdom come. We want everyone in the kingdom come, and that's what we're working towards. That's your hope. It's Martin Luther King, isn't it? It's the arrow of thing bending towards justice. The arrow of thing.
Hi, I am Canadian, not American, just in case people think my accent. It's been happening for a month.
We went to war with the Falklands and we were still British. You can't take responsibility.
Thank you so much for your work and your witness. I actually host a podcast in Canada called Youth... it's another one. Called Eldest Immigrant Daughters. And we actually create space for eldest daughters from immigrant homes around the world who might need a space to be themselves, to be powerful, to actually own their voice and their power for the first time, because there's so much pressure for young women who are raised in immigrant homes to be the parent, to be the provider, to be all these things and not care for themselves. If you could have... I think your character and you as a person is an example of how you can be powerful and a black woman and also care for yourself and center yourself. You have a word for the eldest immigrant daughters of the world. What would you tell them? How would you encourage them today?
Well, I think eldest daughters, full stop, find things quite demanding from all backgrounds. For all those things you said about having to be a caregiver and not having time for yourself and blah, 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 blah. Yes, I think that's true. I think there are extra challenges if you come from a community where you're not the majority. And I have no straightforward answer to that apart from to say it's about celebrating your unique self and finding ways to do that, and finding places that give you encouragement. It may be a person, it may be a tree, it may be a library, it may be pottery. But find the thing that gives you joy, that nourishes you. Because you cope with the world a lot better when you're nourished. We're told to love your neighbour as yourself. You got to love yourself. That's a fundamental. You can't, everything comes from a place of being fueled. It's, put your oxygen mask on before you help. You have to be in a place of internal fortitude and joy. Sometimes it's an act of will to say, today I will be internally fortitudinous and joyful. but everything, Everything is an act of will. Our faith is an act of will. And I think you have to keep returning to that place and make the solidarities where you can. And know that that truth is as powerful as the truth of all the difficulties outside. And that we, you know, I think there's something really fabulous about being a people who are working for the kingdom come. You know, because the kingdom come is here, it's behind us and it's ahead of us. And you know, live, you walk through the world in the kingdom come and you share the kingdom come where you can and you draw the kingdom come to you and you pray for it and you work for it. And, you know, it's a fantastic place to be. And the kingdom come is a place where the eldest daughter of the immigrant family gets a chance to live in her blessing. And so that's where you want to place yourself.
Thank you so much, Adjoa. I have loved that conversation. Thank you for the joy and the wisdom and the inspiration that you've brought. And thank you for being with us at Greenbelt and hope you come back.
I will. And just remember, it takes a child. Let's make the child the baby Jesus and I can get away with it.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.